Sir Andrew Dilnot, our guest today, in a way, is Mr. Social Science, a career of distinction built on the disciplines for which he was rewarded with a knighthood. Today, he is the warden of Nuffield College, Oxford, the famous graduate college that specialises in the social sciences, with a clutch of former fellows winning Nobel Prizes. Social science is in Andrew's blood. Before Nuffield, he worked for the Institute for Fiscal Studies for 21 years, the last 11 as director. A fierce advocate for statistics, he believes before you begin to analyse any issue, whether social care or low productivity, you have to marshal the data. Only then can you get near a solution. And the UK's social care system, or not so much a system but a lottery, is on a precipice. Two-thirds of people who've used or had contact with social care said they were dissatisfied with the service they'd received or witnessed, according to a recent British Social Attitudes survey. And beyond just dissatisfaction lie damning figures. There were over 165,000 adult social care posts left vacant last year. What can be done? And what can the stats tell us? Andrew published his report on social care 12 years ago, and still nothing has been done. So, for his views on that and the gamut of issues facing social science, here is the man himself. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sir Andrew Dilnot, direct from Nuffield College, Oxford.
It's great to be with you.
First off, you began your career at the Institute for Fiscal Studies back in 81, and here we are in 2023. What big things, if you had to single out three big things that have changed or are of remark that either worry you or delight you over that period, what would they be?
So one big thing that has changed that we knew even back then was going to change, but still I think we're struggling to adjust to it in this country and around the world, is how much longer we're all living. So the aging of the population has been really striking. If we go a bit longer than the start of my and your working lives, if we go back to 1901, in this country there were 61,000 people aged over 80. By 2011, there were 1.447 million, an increase of a multiple of 25. By 2030, we think there'll be 3 million people in that category. And that's something fantastic. It's great they're all living longer. In many ways, that's what we would all be looking for. But I don't think we've yet adjusted in all sorts of ways to that. I don't think we've adjusted to it fully as individuals. We haven't adjusted to it as a society. How we manage pensions and, of course, I would say this, how we manage social care. That's a huge issue that we just haven't addressed properly. So that's one very big change that I think is good, but has some tricky consequences that we haven't addressed. Massive growth, further growth in the number of people going to university. I think that's an extraordinary and wonderful thing. And not just growth in the total numbers, but shift in the gender balance. So again, if we go back slightly further, we go back to the early 1950s. The early 1950s, there were about 3,500 women in the UK going to university each year, and about 40,000 men. Now we're at over 300,000 women and a bit less than 300,000 men. So a huge increase in the overall number, but also a massive shift in one of the really critical gender inequalities. And of course, we're not, you know, there are all kinds of inequalities of many types, including gendered, that are still there. But that has been an astonishing transformation that I think we don't pay enough attention to. That's something really to delight in. And then with a slightly more statistical sense, just the availability of data has been transformed over the last 45 years. So when I first worked at the IFS, and actually, I'm afraid to say, Will, there was a mistake in your introduction. I didn't start working at the IFS in 1981. I started working full time at the IFS in 1981. I had the astonishing opportunity to go and work as a summer student while I was still an undergraduate in 1980. In 1980, I can remember being there in the summer. We were using the computing service in Oxford, a mainframe computer in Oxford, that reputedly, I don't think this is true, but the anecdote was that it consumed as much water to keep itself cool as the domestic consumption of Oxford. As I said, I don't think it was true. there was a noise that I thought was a pneumatic drill, which was actually the card reader. This was a whole different technology. By 1981, it was possible to use PCs, microcomputers, to analyze data from the family expenditure survey. And so for the first time at the IFS, we were able to, in something like real time, look at the distribution of income, write programs that would allow us to assess the impact of potential changes to the tax and social security system on the distribution of income. What's happened over the last 40 years has been an astonishing multiplication of that. So the amount of data and its richness that is available now for social scientists to start to understand more about how the labour market works, how an education system or a health system is working, what kinds of decisions people are making about retirement, all of that stuff. There's now almost too much data to look at, and that means that we can answer all kinds of questions that simply were impossible before.
Well, we're going to look at some of those questions over the next half an hour. I'm very struck, actually, social science, you go back to the 1890s, the early part of the 20th century, people looked to social science and data, very primitive as it was, but they thought, we're really going to kind of solve the world's issues with this. You know, the great surveys by Booth of London and T-Bone Rowntree in York. But I mean, little progress was made. And again, there was hopeful in run-up to the Second World War. And now you're telling us we can do all these wonderful things now with all this data. Are we making enough progress with the statistics and the data and the analysis and the trends and what we know about ourselves? Is enough being acted upon, given that we know so much more about, you know, our social and economic structures?
I think probably the answer to that is inevitably no and never. We never make as much progress as we would like. And one of the things that I suppose is most worrying is whether policy decisions are as informed by data and analysis they should be. And my own reflection after these few decades of working in these areas is that I sometimes think that we pay too much attention to policy and not enough attention to the ways in which the world changes that aren't driven by policy, that might be driven, for example, by technological change, by better understanding. So in some senses, you know, what's one of the most important changes that's occurred in the last 100 years or so? The massive reduction in infant mortality rates from beginning of the last century, one child in 10 dying before the age of 5, to in this country, that number being now around 3 in 1,000. Not much of that has been the result of explicit policy changes by government. Governments pulling levers. A lot of it has been technological change, better understanding of hygiene, better medication.
Yeah.
And I do think there's a tendency for us all to get caught up in a bubble where we think the most important thing that can be done is a change in policy, when often the most important things that have happened have been the result of technological change, of behavioural change, of changes in attitudes. You know, the increase in the number of women going to university hasn't come about because a government pulled a particular lever. It's come about because we've changed our attitudes from attitudes that were wrong towards the idea of women going to university to attitudes that now welcome and support it on the whole, not of course everywhere and at all times. So it's not all about policy.
Hold that thought, because I am going to come back to that. But I just want to kind of push you a bit about, you know, the British economy in the early 2020s, or we enter the mid-2020s. Productivity flat for the best part of 15 years, stagnant real wages, public services under tremendous pressure, debt service, the cost of actually servicing our national debt, for a bunch of reasons that we know well, has now approached 10% of all tax receipts. Our international accounts are all over the place. How do you see it? I mean, are you going to pull me up and say, well, that's far too pessimistic, here's all these bright spots, or I agree with you, and here's more worrying figures? Give us, first of all, just give us a rounded picture of actually how serious you think our national plight is, and then kind of give us some pointers about, You've only got a couple of minutes here, Andrew, but a couple of pointers about, you know, what you would focus on, and then let's home in on those.
Well, so I don't think we're looking very different from the rest of the developed world. And one of the things that's happened in the last few weeks is there have been some revisions to our estimates of the overall size of the market economy that now make it look as though the performance of the UK is roughly in the middle of the performance of the developed nations in the post-COVID period. And I think there's something a bit chastening there, which is to remember that all data when it comes out is an estimate and it can change later. And the second is that we're a pretty small nation and it's going to be unusual for us to be performing or behaving in ways that look very different to those around us. The story of the British economy is, on the whole, the story of the world economy, and British politicians and academics and public servants and journalists are, you know, we're a bit less important than it sometimes would be tempting to think we are.
That's a disgrace. What a disgraceful thing to say. I can't believe you've said that.
We're driven by the world. We're now a very small part of the world, and we respond as the rest of it does. Let me talk though a bit more about something where I could claim to have a bit more experience and knowledge, and that's the size of the level of public spending, the size of the national debt, which is something that people have got very agitated about.
Yeah, go there.
The stock of debt as a share of national income is now roughly 100%, maybe a little bit less than that. And that is higher than it's been for most of the period since 1960. But it's lower than it was for most of the period from the First World War to 1960. And it's lower than it was for the whole of the period from 1750 to 1850. And the highest it's been is more than 250% of national income.
It's not the stock, is it? It's the cost of servicing it that really is the...
So the cost of servicing it at the moment is high because inflation is high and we have quite a lot of index-linked debt. This is an area where I just think as economists and as policymakers, we haven't done a very good job. We talk about things that we say are fiscal rules, and the rule might be, depending on who the government is and when it was last changed, it might be that the stock of national debt should fall or that we should only borrow to invest. These are very inadequate ways of thinking about borrowing. If we think about how we think about borrowing for ourselves, if we think about borrowing as individuals, then we might want to borrow to buy a house. And there what we're doing is we're borrowing money so we can buy something we'll use over a long period. And we do it if we think the price that we will pay for the asset and the borrowing is less than the value of the consumption to us. Well, we should be applying those kinds of rules to the way we think about what we do together. Government is, in the end, just what we do together. So very odd simply to have a rule that says it should fall. There could easily be occasions, as we saw in both COVID and the response to the war in Ukraine, when that's just not the right thing to do. We should be evaluating borrowing in that light. And we should remember that it's true that we have a higher stock of borrowing and therefore a higher cost of servicing the debt than one of the other G7 countries, Germany. But every other G7 country has a higher and in some cases much higher level of national debt than we do. In Japan, for example, it's over 250%.
Yes, I struggle with this. I mean, I spent most of my working life trying to make that argument, and also to try and make the argument, which is kind of ancillary to it, that you know, one should look at the kind of stock of national assets and actually the kinds of things that, you know, you're spending money on. I mean, I really believe that a kind of well-designed investment program financed by borrowing that palpably was going to kind of lift productivity and growth in the medium term would actually not freak out the financial markets, actually. It was kind of Liz Truss's unfunded tax cuts that freaked out the markets. Nonetheless, I mean, I for the first time, and put my fears to rest. It was only 15 years ago where the kind of average length of British public debt was 14 or 15 years, the longest in the G7. Now it's 2 years because of the impact of quantitative easing. And that's very, very, very kind of susceptible to short-term
change in interest rates because the character of that. And then you've got, you know, about a quarter of national debt is indexed to inflation. And that has swollen forever as a result of the inflation of the last kind of 2 years and ongoingly into next year. So, you know, it's kind of a thing. And actually, either one has to grow faster or one has to have a higher tax base or one way or another, you know, one's got to kind of manage it. As well as organise investment. I mean, as well as tell people not to worry about the actual stock.
So I agree with all of that. So there is no doubt a short-term issue with the current servicing of the national debt. But I think it is a short-term issue.
Yeah, in the long run.
I think the crunch issue, and in a way this may relate to some stuff that you want to talk about later in the context of the social care, is how we address what we want the state to be doing. And one of the things that I think I can see over the 40-odd years that I've been looking at this is that, on the whole, we've gone on as a society and as politicians wanting to increase spending in certain areas. Health is one obvious example. The other is support of older people. As the number of older people has grown massively, so the cost of paying pensions and other forms of support to them has grown massively. So we've gone on increasing a whole set of things which you'd expect us to want to spend more on as we get wealthier. And we haven't wanted, on the whole, to do that by increasing the overall level of taxation. So we've cut other things. And at the beginning of the post-war period, there was an easy thing to cut, and that was defence, which had been 9% of national income, is now down to 2%. But then we've ended up cutting infrastructure and capital projects, and there's now nothing left to cut. And it's also worth noting that one of the consequences of increasing spending as a share of national income on health and on support for older people has been that at the same time we've reduced the share of national income that we spend on education.
It's a disgrace. Thinking
back to your what are three changes, the change that probably bothers me most of all is that in 1975-6 we spent 6% of national income on education, and now we spend between 4 and 4.5% of national income on education.
It's a disgrace.
And how can it
possibly be the case
that over a 50-year period, when we've grown on average much better off, real incomes have grown a lot? Surely education is something that, in economist terms, we'd call a luxury good. The income elasticity of demand is greater than one. As you get richer, you want to spend more of your income on education.
Thank you for explaining
that.
Thank you for explaining that. I'm sure some listeners won't know what the elasticity of demand means. Yeah.
But how on earth have we managed as a society to reduce by a quarter the share of our economy that we dedicate to education? I mean, this just, it just seems, to use a technical term, bonkers.
Well, some of it has gone off balance sheet with student loans, hasn't it? I mean, I guess you could say.
Yes, but the number of students has grown. In 1975-6, the number of students in higher education was tiny relative to now. It's true that there have been some demographic changes, but basically we have reduced the proportion of our economy that we spend on education, and that seems very, very surprising.
I just want to take a moment to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the We Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation.
We have not, as a community, been grown up and honest about how much we want to spend on the things that we do together. And the challenge that has faced a whole series of governments since the mid-1970s is that we want to spend more on our healthcare. We want to spend more on looking after those, paying pensions to those, the increasing number of people who are over pension age. But we haven't worked out whether there's something that we're willing to stop doing together or whether we're willing to pay more for this. And of course, if these were all things that we did on our own, then we'd find those changes very easy. So if we look at the composition of consumption that is organised individually, it changes very radically. The proportion of our total consumption that goes on food has fallen very dramatically over the last 50 years, because as we on average have got richer, on average we spend a smaller proportion of our income on food. The proportion of our income that we spend on transport has gone from 4% to 12%. Because as we get richer, we choose to do more of that. We're very good at adjusting our individual consumption. What we're very poor at, and what the political system has been very poor at, is adjusting our communal consumption. There's no doubt that we all want to spend more on healthcare. We probably, most of us, want to spend more on education. We probably, most of us, want to spend more on our incomes in retirement. But the consequence of that is we need to spend more together. And if we're going to go on doing all the things that we're doing at the moment, that means that taxes need to go on going up. And that's why we have a higher level of taxation now than we've had in the post-war period, despite having a government that you think on the whole for the last 13 years would have been in favour of lower rather than higher taxes. But the truth is that the expectation of consumption, of public consumption, has meant that those tax levels have stayed up. And we need to have an honest debate about what we're going to do over the next 20 years. If we want to go on with the kinds of structures we have at the moment, paying people like you and me a pension in retirement through the state, paying our healthcare, paying for our children's education, then we're going to need taxes to go up. And if we don't want taxes to go up, we're going to have to make some choices that most people find very unpalatable. We're not very honest about that. The political debate here is very poor.
Of course, I buy all that. I mean, it's kind of, it follows inexorably from the data. And but I want to really challenge, I want to call you out a bit and call a spade a spade. I mean, what you're saying is that, you know, things we do communally, the we, are going up for all the reasons that, for very good reasons, we all both understand and are clear to all our listeners. But actually, there's an unwillingness to pay for them. Okay, and that, but that's not, that doesn't happen in a vacuum. Oh, you know, your first internship was in the summer of 1980, 1 year into Mrs. Thatcher's premiership. I mean, you've lived through 40 years of this great kind of what some people call the neoliberalism. I prefer to call it actually kind of the age of individualism, actually, in which the politics has all been about choice, individualism, freedom, the magic of the market. I mean, we all know that language, and it's because conservative politicians who've been in power for most of that time in Britain have actually wanted to run with that ball, because that's their ideology, backed by a very powerful right-wing media ecosystem, have made the discourse of saying, hold on a minute, guys, what about the we? What about the communal? Kind of impossible to argue. And it's been overwhelmed by this counter-argument that what matters is this world of the I. That's why it's so difficult to get this argument off the ground, isn't it?
So that's a perfectly plausible... So I honestly, I don't know why it's so difficult to get this argument off the ground. I wish I did.
I put one argument to you, but perhaps I'm wrong.
That's a perfectly plausible explanation. I don't feel fit to decide whether it's the right explanation. So my hunch is it's definitely a part of it. But it has been across the political spectrum that it's been across the political spectrum that this debate has not been had honestly. And I think it's been as true of politicians of the left as it has been of the right. I think that they're all, there is nowhere, as far as I can see, an honest addressing of this. And I think, I mean, I do think social science has something to answer for here. I think that we need to work hard to explain why, what the arguments are for communal consumption and what the level of it is. And I think even language can matter here. So we talk a lot about public expenditure as though it's something that we do for somebody else. Yeah. It's actually public consumption.
Ah, very good point.
We are consuming healthcare together. Of course, there are ways in which at any one time the NHS could be even better than it is. And there may be ways at the moment in which it's bad. I wouldn't claim to be expert on that. But what I do know is that we spend less, a smaller proportion of our economy on healthcare than most of our comparators. And we spend only about half as large a share of our economy on healthcare as is spent in the US. And state spending on healthcare, public spending on healthcare in the US is nearly as large a share of the economy as we spend in the UK on the NHS. And then they spend the same again on top of that. So we haven't got the story right here. We haven't helped people to understand. And this relates to the work that I did on social care.
Well, go on. You have a platform to tell us the story. You've begun it. So, let me put you on the spot.
The story is really, in many ways, it goes back to ideas that were being talked about in Bismarck's Germany in the late 19th century, in the early years of the 20th century by Churchill and Lloyd George, among others, and then reached its kind of its peak, perhaps, in the Beveridge Report and the reforms that were introduced in the post-war period. And the story is this. Let's think about this at its most pared-down level and as an economist. So there are some things which it makes sense for any individual to pay for out of her weekly or monthly or annual income. So on the whole, it's going to make sense to buy your food in that way. You'll just use some of your weekly or monthly income, and you can be pretty sure how much food you're going to need each week or month, and you can plan for that. But then there's another whole class of things where neither spending out of your weekly or monthly income or saving makes sense. And those are things that we want to insure for. So the risk that our house might burn down, the risk that we might get a very serious problem with our healthcare, the risk that we might have an accident in our car. It doesn't make sense to plan to cover those out of our weekly or monthly income. Most of us don't have weekly or monthly income that could anywhere cover the consequence of such a major problem. It also doesn't make any sense to try to save up for them, because for most of us, they're not going to happen. It's not like going on a holiday where you know you're going to want to go on a holiday once a year. For many of us, we're not going to need very, very serious healthcare cover. We're not going to need very lengthy social care problems. Our house is not going to burn down. We're not going to have a car accident. But if those things happen, we need to be sure that we are covered. And these are cases where we need to pool the risk. We need to do it together. And in some of those cases, we can do that through a private insurance market. So the private insurance market works pretty well for cars or houses. In this country, we've chosen to do healthcare through communal risk pooling. So we pay for it together through taxation, and we know that if we have a serious healthcare problem, the state steps in. We can think of education as being a form of social insurance, of risk pooling. It's insuring children against the possibility that their parents won't be able to or won't make good decisions about funding their education. And that's an extraordinary and powerful thing. And it's a great way of consuming. It's a very efficient way of consuming. It's much, much better for me to pay taxes and know that if I have a serious healthcare need, I will have it paid for by the state than to be exposed to all of that risk myself. Now, of course, we could, in the case of health, do that through a private insurance sector.
It was Churchill, wasn't it, who said the law of averages protects millions?
He had a beautiful phrase. He first used it in 1911. He said, "Social insurance brings the magic of averages to the rescue of the millions." It was a kind of brilliant summary of what's going on there. It's a very efficient way of consuming. And I think we've slightly lost the sense in our national discourse of the beauty and brilliance of this way of delivering our education, our healthcare.
And is that because social insurance has got conflated with tax, and that tax is seen as bad and social insurance is seen as somehow good?
I think it's precisely that we don't talk about social insurance very much anymore. We just talk about public expenditure, which sounds almost as though it happens to somebody else. And we talk a great deal about how much we pay in tax and anxieties about that without connecting what we're paying for in tax to the benefits,
the common
in
wheel,
the broader sense that we get from it. And so I think, but on both sides, so this isn't a left-right thing. I think there's a perfectly plausible right-wing perspective on the world that says let's not do so many of the things together that we could do as individuals. Let's, for example, move further down the road of expecting individuals to make their own pension provision. That's a perfectly plausible state of the world. But the honest thing for those on the right to say would be, we want to go on doing, I imagine it would be go on doing health and go on doing education, but there are some aspects of income support in old age which we think we could translate to people taking their own responsibility. On the left, there's a different set of arguments to make about the importance of doing things together and of the support that comes from that, but that if that's what we're going to go down, we need higher taxes. But on no side are we having honesty about any of this.
What other areas, before we finish, would you turn your gaze to that you'd like to have a kind of similar impact on?
It's education. It's the funding of education. And it does feel to me as though the reduction in the proportion of our economy that we allocate to education just feels to me like a mistake and somebody that nobody really wanted and that many people have been unaware of. And I don't know how we get that debate going, but that's probably the thing that I feel most strongly about.
So how do you get... OK, let's sign off on this. Let's give you a minute just to kind of sketch out your thoughts on that. I mean, lift the cap on student fees, which are currently $9,250, and in real terms need to go to 12 grand. Is that one way? Would you extend it to the principle to training so all trainees can borrow and so you make it demand-led? Or does that mean that you get insufferable, intolerable amounts of debt hung around the shoulders of our young people, burdening them for kind of their early career? What's the answer?
I don't know what the answer is, except that the number's wrong. I genuinely think that under almost any plausible set of assumptions, as an economy grows richer, the rational thing, the thing people want to do is spend a larger proportion of the economy's total output on education. We've reduced it by a third in the last, well, a quarter in the last 25, in the last 50 years. That seems to me wrong. It seems to me that we're failing to put into practice what I think almost all individuals would feel, which is the importance of looking after the next generation. And I think rather than it being a question about details of policy, on which I'm simply not expert, or that's something that maybe I'd like to get more expert on.
There's
a bigger existential question about how we value that kind of communal consumption and how we pay for it. And I don't think we've been honest enough about it. And as a result of that, I think we risk letting current generations of little children down. And this is almost the obverse of the social care for the elderly problem. It's hard to get people to think about the difficulties and challenges that some older people face and will face. It's pretty easy to get people to look at and think about primary schools. I cycled past one of my local primary schools on my way into work this morning, and the lifting of the spirit that we all experience seeing little children and their parents and their carers dropping them off and their teachers welcoming them. And that's so enchanting. And you think, well, given how enchanting it is and how important and that sense of potential and delight, and let's get it right.
Absolutely. No, I mean, completely right. I mean, we have amongst the shortest 5-year-olds in Europe because of nutritional problems, and then we just don't spend the money on bringing them, to give them the opportunity to flourish and to acquire whatever, you know, the gods have given them, to develop them so they can kind of make their own lives kind of great, and also in the act make our lives great, because, you know, we all benefit. And in particular, in the 21st century economy, it's obvious, and it's a real must. Well, look, on that note, we should end. It's been a remarkable 45 minutes talking to a leading social scientist like you, hearing you describe your internship in 1980, the magic of growing data, life expectancy, growing numbers of the gender balance at university changing, your view that we should think about public spending as actually collective provision of things that we communally want to have, your notion of risk pooling, which underpins your report on social care, and that final kind of, you know, wonderful image of you cycling past the primary school on your way to work, and what a delight the kids are, and how we should absolutely, absolutely invest in them. Andrew, thank you so much.
It's been a delight, Will. It's been a minute for every year that we've known each other. And it's been one of the great delights of my last 45 years. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we've known each other a long time. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Find out more about the Society by going to www.acss.org.uk. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, so you're the first to know when a new episode comes out.